Good day and welcome to In the Moment Tech Radio. I'm your host, Kent Osborne. It's the 21st of February, and we are cooking right along talking about tech today. We'd love to hear your questions and your comments. You can email them to inthemoment@sdpb.org or shoot us a text, the number 956-SDPB. That's 956-7372. To speak to us live on the air, the number is 800-852-0214. Joining me in the studio today is Amos Aesop, Chief Security Officer at the Sioux Falls technology services company, Exigent. Hello, Amos.
Hey, Kent.
How's Exigent?
Things are good over at Exigent. Always happy in these days when it's a Friday and the weather's going to be good for the weekend.
Weather's going to be outstanding.
Yeah, you can't beat that.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. The Senior Network and Security Architect at the Bureau of Information and Telecommunications and PEER is with us today. Jeffrey Litterick joins us. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hello.
How's BIT?
I'm doing pretty good. Looking forward to the nice weekend, just like Amos is.
Just like everybody else.
Have a change, so yeah.
Yeah. Well, and joining us later in the show, from Vermilion, SDPB's social media maven, Heather Benson will join us, and we're going to have an Elder Tech segment. Talk about online payment systems or how to stay a little safer when we eventually have to go and do transactions online. Some folks are just getting into that, and we have a few safety tips that we'll get to later in the show today. Again, if this is a listener interactive program, if you have a question, we'll try to provide that answer. On Facebook, we are simply facebook.com/techradio. You can post your questions or comments there. Don't be shy. Send us a text, 956-SDPB. That's 956-7372. Again, the phone number, 800-852-0214. And Twitter users, you can send those questions to me at KentSDPB. And of course, the one that counts, the email address, inthemoment@sdpb.org is probably one of the easier ways to get a hold of us. Well, I don't know about the two of you, but I was really bummed this week to hear of the death of Larry Tesler. 74-year-old man who, first of all, did you know who Larry Tesler was before
this? I'm familiar with the story. That's about it.
Okay. Well, he was the guy that invented basically cut, copy, and paste. Mm-hmm. So if you've ever done that, it's the removing, duplicating, or repositioning of text. And when I read it in that form, I can almost remember the first time I was able to take a paragraph and move it.
Yes.
And what I thought I was on top of the world.
Life changing.
Yeah. I don't have to retype that.
Right.
Are you kidding me? No. I can go, oh, yeah, and duplicate it or several times or whatever. It was truly one of those moments in early computing history of me or lore that, you know, that I remember.
Which seems like trivial today, right? I mean, you don't even think twice about moving text or copying paste or search and replace or anything like that.
And back then it was you could only copy and paste within the program, and now you can copy and paste graphics and text between programs and between computers and all over the place. It's one of those major functions that people probably couldn't work on a computer without anymore.
Yeah, it's simply stunning. Somebody had to come up with it, and it was Larry.
It was.
And so rest in peace, Larry.
I hope he got some sort of kickback every time someone did a copy and paste.
I doubt that.
Residual.
Xerox PARC folks, I don't know. Here's how funny this is it was last week I showed somebody how to cut, copy, and paste. And I got to see the joy.
Really?
It was from a Word document into an email. Somebody needed this information, and they didn't have to retype it in the email.
They're familiar with email, but not familiar with cut, copy, paste.
An entire page of notes that needed to be emailed, and I was able to show them how to cut. They wrote it down so they could do it the next time. But the sheer joy, the giggle that I heard.
Was this through the menus, or was it right click, or was it the
keyboard? Actually showed them the keystrokes for Control A to select all, and then Control C to copy, and then
Wow.
Yeah. I just went straight for the keyboard shortcuts. Absolutely. rather than the right clicking and the menuing and all that stuff. So, it was crazy. Heather Benson's joined us now from the mothership in Vermilion. So we'll welcome Heather to the show. Heather, feel free to hop in if you like and tell us your memories of Larry Tesler if you care to. You probably didn't know Larry, but
no, this is all news to me.
Yeah. Great. Excuse me. Yeah. Heather joins us. We're gonna have an Elder Tech segment a little later in the show on staying safe online. So we appreciate Heather being here. Other news. I was interested to see Firefox has debuted a VPN in their browser that you can use to keep safe, and that does tie in with the discussion a little bit later. But it'll be a browser extension, the free version, and then the pay version, of course, pay by the month for up to 5 devices of actual VPN service. I think that's an interesting. I think it was probably, we always had Tor, and we've had Tor for a number of years, and other easy browser extensions for VPN. But I think this is just, isn't this kind of the natural progression of things? Just to integrate VPN into the things that need to be the most secure.
It is, but my question is always, how much do we trust? It's got to exit somewhere. It's got to end up on the internet somewhere. Do you trust that? And for me, my answer is always no. And so if any VPN that I'm going to utilize, I want to have full control over it. And I end up doing it myself. So, but
can I ask?
But Mozilla is probably, of the trustworthy companies,
right,
might be one of the more, right? They just have a pretty good reputation. There's certainly always that question.
So can I ask, do you VPN... Are you a VPN guy, like start to finish everywhere?
No.
Your phone, your home?
Never. I rarely do I VPN. I VPN only if I end up like in a coffee shop where there's open Wi-Fi, right?
Okay.
And that's just to eliminate that issue. Because everything I do these days with HTTPS everywhere, everything's already encrypted anyway. And so I'm not getting any benefit out of it. But that's also because I'm not trying to circumvent any geolocation issues. I'm not trying to watch videos that are only available from the UK. I'm not trying to obfuscate where my IP is coming from in order for people not to be able to track me. My only use for it is to keep the traffic that goes between my computer and the device that might happen to be at the coffee shop or at the library or wherever it happens to be from being intercepted between those two devices. There certainly are other uses for it. I just don't have them. So I
thought I'd be kind
of.
Go ahead, Jeff.
One of the things to keep in mind with VPN, because we just kind of ran into this accidentally at the state, is there's a lot of big service providers starting to block VPN known IP addressing. And what they do is the VPN providers, they just like we said, it has to exit someplace out of the VPN. Those IP addresses are being interrogated automatically by providers and are being blocked. We found out this because most of the K-12 schools in the state were being blocked from Disney Plus because they had labeled those IP address blocks as VPN tunnel endpoints when they weren't. And we got that fixed now, and Access is there. But Disney, and I read this, and in the process of reading this, we found Disney actually uses, when you go to Disney, it checks your IP address and it actually interrogates it. And if you're a VPN, it will block it to prevent people from trying to get around geolocating and stuff like that. And there's actually in the security field, like Tor, which is a type of VPN, there's lists of end nodes now that people are just blocking per se because there's so much malware and other stuff coming from them also. So VPNs are handy and neat, but there's now services that are actively blocking users of VPNs. So do be aware of that.
Yeah, and I think, I think the most common or most frequently, most well-known, and it's simply because of their advertising, I think is NordVPN. I guess that's the one that comes to my mind the most quickly. But then they had a breach, right? So that's the other thing, is that if you're using those services, you're putting literally all those eggs in that basket, that those are going into all those IP addresses, all those packets are all going into that one basket of that one provider who is providing you that service. And if they're doing any logging or if they're doing anything, any sort of storage or anything like that, then your information could be compromised there too.
The VPN that I have used in the past, I was on Reddit one day in the tech forums, and there was a giant post about my VPN had just been bought. And a couple other smaller ones had been bought by a company that had some questionable pasts, past dealings. And so they were just completely freaking out about, you know, okay, so if you're if you're using this particular VPN, now all of a sudden it's bad. And I didn't necessarily subscribe to that, you know, that that thought at the moment, but it makes you question what's going on behind the scenes. And you brought that up. Who do you trust?
Right.
And with the consolidation of apparent consolidation of VPNs, you got to wonder about that.
And remember, a VPN is just one layer also. I mean, if you're already doing HTTPS for all your connections, the VPN provider can't really see your data any more than anybody else can. It's an extra layer on there. And to be honest, sometimes ISPs do weird things or bad things, and people have blocked certain ISPs. And if you're on that ISP, a VPN is the only way to actually gain access to some stuff. So I think of it as a security tool, not the end, the end game. It's going to protect, like the advertisement for Nord, you put this on and you're always protected. You're not. It's just a layer in the defense. And it is a useful tool at times, but it's just a tool that you have to be aware of its limitations.
Yeah. So now that you say that, I remember going to, I don't know if it was Hulu or Netflix or one of the companies to watch something, and had my VPN on, and it said, hey, you've got a VPN on. If you want to use this service, you're going to go shut that off and then come back and then we'll talk. Mm. And so so maybe this went from a, hey, this is a really cool, everybody should probably use, let's all try this Firefox thing, to, boy, this is really going to be a pain in the rear if people start using it and then they're geo blocked out of, or IP blocked out of using services they really want to use.
Right.
Huh. Yeah. We've come full circle from recommending something to cautioning people.
Another good use for VPN I've used in the past is when there's been trouble on the internet, some of the backbone providers. So most of the times my VPN will bypass those trouble spots. So especially when I'm playing games, I've actually noticed sometimes the games are better over the VPN because I'm kind of bypassing some troublesome, connecting peering points. Sometimes that happen. Or when DDoSes are happening, stuff like that. So like I said, it's a useful tool, but it will have limitations, and more people, especially any kind of content company, because they have different films in different regions and they're responsible for copyright holders, are going to kind of block VPN use because a lot of people were using VPNs to get around, oh, well, they only show that movie in Japan, well, I'll just VPN to Japan and watch it through Netflix there, because different regions have different content and that's not always available in the other region. So
yeah, I have heard that like Major League Baseball has blackout areas. But if you're coming from another country, you're not in a blackout zone.
Right.
So I've heard that. So that's interesting. We have about run out of time for the first segment. Want to let everybody know that, again, this is a listener interactive program. If we just made you think of a question for us, that's all right. Give us a call. 800-852-0214 is our number. Our text number is 956-SDPB. That's 956-7372. And our email address is inthemoment@sdpb.org. When we come back, we're going to have a segment we call Elder Tech. It's a kind of a variety of topics that we take on in that segment. But this week, we're going to talk specifically about staying a little safer online with online payment systems. And we're going to be joined by Heather Benson, and we'll do that right after this. Welcome back to In the Moment Tech Radio. I'm Ken Osborne, and we're talking tech with the computer folks today. We are taking your questions and comments about the tech in your life, and we'd love to hear from you. Send your questions by emailing them to inthemoment@sdpb.org or a text to 956-SDPB. That's 956-7372. Well, Heather, welcome again to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's
glad to have you with us. Heather, you're our social media marketing expert at South Dakota Public Broadcasting and just down the hall from my office in Vermilion. And we quite often do a segment on the show, for those that don't listen all the time, called Elder Tech. And it's really about assisting other folks understand and get around technology and the internet in a more useful way. And you had an experience recently that you wanted to share and talk about basically getting and sending money. So you call it the safe online payment processing, but in real terms, you have put together some do's and don'ts of turning your personal financial information over to the wild, wild west of the internet. So what's your first do, Heather? What should we be doing?
Well, I find that people seem to fall into three categories when it comes to doing anything online with their money. There's people who say, nope, never going to happen. There's people who have learned enough to be pretty comfortable with it. And then there are those who think, well, as long as it's online and I've heard it before, it must be safe. And of those three, it's probably the third one that can scare me the most.
Most dangerous, yeah.
Because as with everything on the internet, there's good and there's bad. There's safe spots, there's unsafe spots. There's ways to do things and ways not to do things. So we put together a really quick do and don't list. There's just some really easy things to think about, whether you're a first-time user or you've been doing online payments for a long time, to ask yourself and think about before you type in that credit card number and find a whole bunch of fraudulent charges the next day.
Okay.
And the very first one is use the right payment method. It's pretty much across the board where you ask the FTC, the Better Business Bureau, anyone, that in most cases it's a better idea to use your credit card instead of a debit card. And the reason is twofold. The credit card, most major credit cards have really good dispute resolution. If something does happen, if there is a fraud on there, they can deal with it and shut it down in a really timely manner. And the major ones tend to be really on top of that stuff. Not to knock small local banks, but when you're the smaller you are and the less availability to people in the tech field you have, sometimes there aren't those layers of protection with your bank. But the flip side of that is let's say I have my credit card and someone does $500 in charges. Most cases, MasterCard is going to go ahead and, you know, help me out right away. However, if it's $500 out of my checking account that I plan on paying my mortgage with, it might take, even in the best of banks, a day or two for that to get resolved. And in the meantime, I don't have that $500. And in most people's checking accounts, except for maybe those who have more in theirs than I do, that $500 or $250 or $90 missing for 2, 3, 4 days, maybe even longer, can cause some real issues. So if you can use a credit card, try to avoid using that debit card. And if you use online payments, if you're buying a lot of things online, if you're on eBay all the time, or you use a lot of different online shopping, it's sometimes a good idea to have a credit card that's just for online shopping. That way, if you have a credit card to use for everyday life that you don't want to have interrupted when you go to buy groceries at Hy-Vee, and that other one's shut down because something happened online, you have that firewall in between them. And if you absolutely hate credit cards and you don't want to have one, which is a totally understandable way to go out of business, instead of still using your debit card, consider getting one of those prepaid cash cards, because then at least it's only the $100 or $500 or what have you put on that cash card, not the entirety of your bank account that's at risk.
That would be bad.
That would be bad.
to get a notice that that doesn't work anymore,
yep,
and there's a reason for that.
Or your account is empty and, you know, your mortgage and your electric bill and your phone bill are all due to come out.
Okay.
And the next level is use the right payment platform. So if you're on Amazon or eBay or Etsy, most of those have their own services and their own way of doing things. And the big ones, generally speaking, have pretty good consumer protection. When you get onto, you know, Joe Bob's Clock Supplies, and it's an TTPS website, so you know it's secure, but you don't know what payment processing he's using. It's just put in your credit card number and your billing address. If there's a way you can go and use PayPal or use an alternative method, I would highly recommend it. Every every place I looked online before I did this article, like I said, the FTC, Better Business Bureau, Consumer Reports say if you're not sure of it, try to back up and use something that's known. PayPal is a great example. They have a pretty robust purchase protection program that covers both buyers and sellers. And the great thing about PayPal is even if you're using your credit card as your funding mechanism, PayPal's covering up your billing address and all that other personal information that you might be typing in. And every layer you can add, the better off you are. And then the last few are really kind of common sense things. If there's, I think every day I see a new ad on Facebook or in Google or even on television at this point for new payment options. I think a lot of people are pretty aware of the peer-to-peer, which is where I want to send Kent money and we're splitting a pizza. I can just send you the $5 while we're sitting at the table together. Not to say that those are bad ways to do things, but just because it's new and shiny and the guy you're buying a pool table from on Facebook says, hey, use this, doesn't mean you should just rush in and use it. Do a little research. Figure out if they've been around. You guys just talked about the whole VPN thing. Ask your question, who do you trust? generally, backing up again, if you can use a really well-known processor with known consumer fraud protection like PayPal, try to do that. And that comes back to just using good internet hygiene. If you're going to be using your phone or computer to make payments, you need to be sure that phone or computer is secure. If your device is not secure, if you have a virus on there, if you have malware on there that's tracking your keystrokes and recording your credit card numbers, it doesn't matter what you're using. You just left yourself open. So day-to-day, good internet hygiene is key. And if it doesn't feel right, don't do it. If things seem really off and the guy asking you to send you money on this brand new shiny app doesn't feel right, you don't have to make that purchase. There's very few things that we have to buy, and ask yourself if you really want to be putting yourself and your financial information at risk.
And if you do, if the answer is yes, use a credit card, not your debit card.
Use a credit card because that's easier to deal with.
Okay. Well, that's quite a wealth of information. I did indeed learn something there. If you have a question for Heather or about online payment systems, shoot us an email in the moment at sdpb.org or text us 956-SDPB. That's 956-7372. Well, what about, and I'll open this up to Jeff or Amos or anyone, what about the new services? So I've had people say, hey, do you Venmo? And I'm like, nope, I don't. how else can you send me money? I have used PayPal because they were around in the early days of eBay, and that's how you got things done. And since then, eBay was, they're a Google company now, and so is PayPal. So that's all, you're all swimming in the same ecosystem there with the big guys with PayPal. What about the newer? I know my watch prompts me to set up Samsung Pay, and there's Apple Pay. I see that you can tap your card now or your phone at the latest gas station. Is that better or worse to set those up? And do you still use those through a credit card, or do you do the bank accounts with those, or what's the best practice on that?
I'll jump in and say one thing to really keep in mind is whatever system you use, you want to be able to keep track of it, and you want to know that you're checking it regularly for fraudulent charges and having that front of mind on your day-to-day life. So I think less is more in this scenario. Pick one or two providers if you're doing a lot of transactions and stick with them, because if suddenly you have 11 different accounts, which might all be with great providers with great consumer fraud protection, that's 11 passwords you've set up, that's 11 places you should check to make sure everything's going okay. Just from an attention span of the average human being, less is probably more. But I'll let the other guys jump in here too.
Yeah. I'll jump in here a bit. Apple Pay is not too bad, but for any kind of payment where you're trusting, especially when you're tying bank accounts and stuff, because if someone breaks your Apple Pay and drains your account and you have your bank account tied to it, well, the money just came out of your bank and you're kind of in the same situation we were talking about earlier with using a debit card. So you do want to take time and let these services vet themselves out and make sure they're secure. Apple is one we kind of trust automatically. PayPal, a lot of people didn't trust it for many years, and there were frauds, and people were finding issues around the system. But now it's a pretty solid thing. One thing I will mention with PayPal and a lot of these new features is you can tie your credit card. That's how I do it. I have a credit card for internet purchases. It's tied to the PayPal and on that account, and I don't tie my bank to it. I don't tie my other credit cards to that particular PayPal account, and I use that. Because one of the things that can happen is there's also all these services called have something called automatic billing, where once you type in your password with a merchant, they can actually request an automatic billing where they can auto bill you in the future. This is mainly like my VPN is auto billed. Netflix can do this, where it auto bills you so you don't have to go to Netflix and type in your PayPal password each time. Well, be careful with those because any vendor at any time could just suddenly charge you any amount. Without you knowing until you get the email from the service saying, hey, we just set a payment of $5,000 to Netflix, as an example, or something like that. So be aware with all these services, any automatic payments, I tend to go in and cancel them unless I truly want them. When I stop using Netflix, I go in and cancel it. So there's just no way it can ever be abused. But on the new services, you know, big name companies that have a lot of stake, you trust more. I would otherwise let everyone else vet themselves out over time.
Okay, let someone else blaze the trail. And that was a good comment on the. So you've sort of isolated the one credit card for the online purchases versus I don't want to say in real life, but a place you're going to walk up and hand a payment to. And sometimes even then you have to watch. I've heard of sketchy things happening, with vendors and street vendors and other things that you just have to watch and be careful.
In Sioux Falls and Rapid, there have been numerous skimmers found on gas pumps, requiring your information. And there's even ATM. And I tend to get these pictures of the really good ones because it's kind of shared in the security community. There's ATMs where I couldn't tell. Until it was pointed out that how they had been hacked so that they were stealing everybody's card and PIN that were using the ATM. They had implemented cameras. They had replaced the whole front of the ATM machine. And we do have stories in both Rapid and Sioux Falls, and I think Vermilion had one, where gas pumps get compromised overnight. And until they're found out, anyone who's used it to pay at the gas pump, well, you've been compromised. So, and then another thing that used to be really big is restaurants. You know how they take the credit card? Well, waiters or waitresses used to just skim the card into a kind of a handheld memory storage device, swipe that card through there, and store that information because it's out of sight, right? Are you watching what they're doing with that card every second? So you do need to be kind of where I have a card just for restaurants for that one too, that it's not used. It's kind of like my internet one. I'm not going to use it. I don't keep any good balance on this. So even if it got compromised, good luck on trying to get a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, anytime the card's out of my possession at all in any way, that's a special card. And that includes online purchases.
I just had this issue happen. As a matter of fact, I got a message at 11 o'clock at night that said, are you trying to, and this is weird, are you trying to buy drinks on Allegiant? And I was at home watching TV, but I had bought drinks on Allegiant 8 weeks before. So my card was considered compromised, so they had to send me a new one. That was a benefit of using a credit card. But that was one of those times, like Jeff is talking about, where I handed over my card to somebody else. Wasn't out of my sight for very long, right? Because they're right there in the aisleway with you, but it doesn't take long to make a copy of a card.
That's scary. We have a text asking us to comment on paperless billing. It says it bugs me. They prefer both. Any reason one way or the other to keep paper billing or just going paperless? Is there a thought on that?
I'll give my thoughts because I tend to do both, and I like paper. Because a couple of things I noticed, and we'll see this month, sometimes I don't get the paperless bill in my email. And it's not it went to spam because I checked spam. I actually had on a couple accounts have to put little reminders to go check because it's a monthly statement. And a couple times I just haven't ever gotten the email that I need to go in and pay. And I don't like auto pay for kind of the reasons I already talked about. I like to go in and manually click so I know exactly when the money and how much is coming out of the account so I can double check stuff. But the paper is a good backup option because you're going to get it in the mail and you're going to see it and it's going to remind you, hey, this is due on this date and stuff like that. So I've kind of gone to the dual method where I like in paper. I also get the email alerts and stuff. And I do most of the pay if I can online with through PayPal and stuff. But I like having that reminder backup just in case, because I don't want to get like my mortgage, suddenly get a call from the bank that, hey, you're overdue on your mortgage. And, I totally forgot. I never received the paper and never got an email and just spaced it off and forgot to, you know, click the button to pay it. So I kind of like both.
And I will say the text notifications from different companies, when especially when it comes to credit cards, I tend to like going in and turning those on. Mm-hmm. And as many options as they give me, when my account balance is this, when a certain amount over this is charged, or every single time a charge is posted, do you want a text? And I tend to overreact on that and say yes. I like to get that. I guess it's what am I looking for? Peace of mind.
I agree with you there, Ken. I tend to use all those services as well, and for the online billing that I do. We use pretty much all paperless billing at our house in that I don't get any of my statements via the postal service. But that doesn't necessarily mean we do automatic payments for each. And for me, it really depends on the usability of the website. If I need to go get a copy of my electric bill for whatever reason, it needs to be easy to download in a decent format and accessible. And that's not true of every provider. So in our house, it's a case by case, and it's also do you need my bank account, or do you want to, you know, what financial information do you need from me in order to do your auto billing system? So I think it's a use your best judgment and who you're comfortable with and what is your force of habit. But in any scenario that you can get a text notification for a bill is due or your account level is dropped or there's a new charge on your credit card, I think those are a great thing to sign up for, because we read our texts. We might ignore a lot of other things like emails, what have you, but most of us read our texts.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. Well,
and it also allows you to contact your bank or your provider that much faster and get kind of what I call ahead of the game, especially on my bank account stuff, because once the money's left in the checking, and we mentioned this before, it can take days before you might be able to get back. So, yeah, I have a whole bunch of limits. And even on my debit card, I actually have a daily withdrawal limit so that if you try to go above a certain amount, it just shuts the card down unless it's pre-approved. So I tend to really keep close tabs on my bank account with all that stuff.
Well, great tips in this segment. Heather, thanks for joining us. You're welcome to stay the rest of the show if you care to. But we will get this posted. We'll get it in blog form shortly. And then probably the easiest way to find it, Heather, is maybe our Facebook page for now.
Yep.
That's facebook.com/techradio. After that, it'll be at sdpb.org. And in the Explore section, you will be able to find this technology blog with some do's and don'ts for online payment systems. Thank you, Heather. We'll be back with more of Tech Radio. We'll have some product highlights and talk about some new technology and some limitations that the FAA is beginning to start to ponder on your drone usage. But we'll get to that after this quick break. Welcome back to In the Moment Tech Radio. I'm Kat Osborne. We're here with Amos Aesop and Jeff Litterick talking tech today. And in our third roundtable segment, I'm going to get this thing started. If you're a drone user and you're listening to my voice, of great interest to you should be an FAA proposed regulation. And they're in a comment period right now. This is the reason I mention this. It's getting to be late in the day on this. They're taking comments through March 2nd. So it would be a good time to get educated and make a few comments, if you care to, about some proposed rule changes with the FAA. Right now, drones that are about a half a pound, 0.55 pounds and above up to 55 pounds need to be registered with the FAA. Whether you're, I guess, a recreational flyer or you're a Part 107, which is the regulations where you go and take a class and get certified and you're able to fly commercially, you do need to register your aircraft with the FAA. The proposed legislation, and by the way, the aircraft that we looked at today, Amos, is just under 0.55 pounds. It's one gram less than is regulatorily necessary. Absolutely by design. But in the future, they are going to impose, and it says it's going to be 36 months after, in a rolling period, after the adoption of the regulations, they're going to do something called UAV remote identification. And what this is the ability for the aircraft and your ground station to constantly be in contact with the government, relaying your identity, your location, your altitude, and your control location at all times. And this is fairly significant. One, because my aircraft and ground station are capable of doing that. Maybe it is with DJI, but many of other drones that are out there right now, racing drones and other drones, toys, and even some of the bigger ones, especially older drones, don't have that capability. And they're saying, sure, in the next 4 years or so, if you are not capable of remote ID, or you're not capable of upgrading your drone and system to remote ID, or somehow attaching a third-party device to be able to do this, you're grounded.
My guess, though, is people who are interested in drones are the type of people who... Oh, go ahead, Jeff.
Okay. I will make one little correction. It's not that you're capable, it's that you will broadcast at all times.
Yes, okay.
Your location and operator ID. So that at any time, just kind of like we have a national flight database, you can go up and look and see where the airplanes are at any place. Anyone could, for government law enforcement, can go in, see the drone, and also see who owns that drone. So anytime it's flying, and this actually gets a little more outside drones. If you think of the old RC airplanes and stuff, mm-hmm, this will apply to them too, the model planes people fly around and stuff. Anytime it's in the air, it should be broadcasting all the time this information the FAA wants. And then anyone who wants to see it or get it can access it either through a radio receiver or through other databases and stuff. It's kind of interesting. It opened a lot of stuff for the big companies who are on it, like Amazon and UPS, because it opens kind of monitoring and tracking of the drone airways, so to speak, so that there can be many more drones in the air and people kind of know what's going on. And law enforcement wants it because, well, they know every drone and they know that's a UPS or Amazon drone, not a terrorist drone flying over the stadium or something like that. So I have a feeling this is going to go through, and most drones will be, because they already have a radio transmitter in them, probably can be adjusted to support this in some way. And there are 3 years before it has to be in there, but a lot of the newer drones should be backwards compatible. But it's kind of Big Brother, big time, spying on everybody doing any kind of drone or hobbyist work.
Yes. Amos, do you want to go ahead and finish your...
Well, I was just going to say, you know, anybody who's doing that sort of drone stuff within 4 years, if you haven't upgraded your drone or if you haven't gotten a new one, I mean, it's unrealistic or unlikely that you're just going to have a 9-year-old drone that can't support that technology. That's just the nature of that game. Plus, what we're looking at here is just the continuation of, like what Jeff was saying, we've had this for a long time with... airplanes, you can go to FlightAware, FlightTracker.com, and see what airplane is where. You know, you literally look up above you, see what, you know, what the call letters are, who owns it, where it's going, that sort of stuff. This is just getting, bringing that down into the smaller sizes, which is probably a good idea that we get ahead of that game before there becomes too many devices. And it starts becoming congested, and there are accidents, right? Because an accident in the air is significantly different than an accident that might happen on the ground in a car.
Well, maybe the same result, but maybe not. I don't know.
Right.
I get what you're saying. So safety first always. I mean,
sure.
I mean, that's how a lot of regulations got rammed through after 9/11. It was for security or Homeland Security or this security or that security. So right. This is just coming down the pipes the same way. But so I'll just anecdotally say that DJI released an app, mm-hmm. and it shows the location of the drone in your area and the location of the drone operator. And that's got people completely freaking out because somebody that's angry or uneducated about drones or think that they're spying on them or whatever can see where that drone operator is and immediately go there and assault them or accost sure. them or
so
rob
other people,
them.
Other than the people who are using
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
So I can go
so
look
open
and
database
what,
and app on your phone.
What DJI are yep. flying around here?
Yep.
Sorry.
Cool.
You don't have to immediately, because on any of the bigger drones where you are registered with the FCC because of the operator ID broadcast, you'll just go to the FAA and look up your name, address, and all your contact information, and they can pay you a visit 2-3 days later.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't have to be real time, because once that operator ID is given out, people will be able to look up and get your real life information. And there's lots of concerns about this, yes.
And my drone is considered a toy. It's light enough that I don't have to register it. I could voluntarily do that and get an aircraft number and put it on there and do all the things, but I choose not to. It's my $5. I don't want to do it. But in the future scenario, if you're not supposed to fly over 400 feet, if I went 401 feet, all of a sudden, I've violated this sacred rule, and you're right. Three, five days later, maybe they'll auto issue me a ticket in the mail. I don't know, but it just seems really draconian right off the bat. And I understand the safety reasons and why they do that. There certainly are knuckleheads out there with drones doing things that they shouldn't do, mounting guns on them and going around and shooting and dropping drugs and cell phones into prison yards, muling drugs across borders. There's certainly people using drones for nefarious reasons. It's just that I'm not doing any of those things. I just like doing drone photography. And, sure. So it's coming. I guess that's the message of the day.
And there's, just so you know, and everyone listening, there's a couple of different options for the broadcasting method. But if you have certain drone size and stuff, you actually have to kind of get almost a cellular-type subscription so that it broadcasts on the cellular side also, so it can go into the national, real-time, nationwide databases. And, that's going to cost. That's going to be a monthly kind of data subscription that you are going to have to pay to be able to fly your drone around. So,
And this exemption for toys and things under a certain certain weight restriction is not going to be there anymore. And even hobbyists that build their own need to build it in, or eventually your aircraft is grounded. It's considered, if you can think about it, a household item in many houses now, just being all of a sudden it's illegal, or you're not supposed to fly it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing with federal laws, I haven't looked up exactly. Most of that kind of stuff is also an automatic felony. It's not like it's a $100 fine, a misdemeanor. Most of them are like one jail and $5,000, $10,000 fine kind of stuff, because they're kind of over from the airplane side of the world in terms of enforcement on a lot of these kind of airway rules and stuff. So, it can be a serious issue if you do break them.
Yeah. So again, if you're interested in this, or this, you have a drone, or you're thinking of getting a drone or purchasing a drone, friend has a drone, you want to make a comment on this. The comment period is open now till March 2nd, and I did put a link on Facebook, mm-hmm. facebook.com/techradio. There's a link to the actual regulation itself, and then on the right hand side of the page, I believe you can leave a comment and you can read the comments. There's almost 20,000 comments there now. You can read all of them if you care to, and see what people are saying about the proposed collection of your identity, location, altitude, and content and control location. So if you're interested in that, that's
there you go.
that's that. But we'll move on from drones now. Jeff, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about GeForce Now, a service from NVIDIA for the streaming of gaming. They got big soon, didn't they? Or really fast?
Well, it's been in beta for 3 years, so they've kind of slow rolled, tagging compared to the Google Strata, which is a competing type system. And there's another one coming out here soon too, from makers of Doom and stuff like that. Just can't remember the name, but streaming of games has become a big thing. Xbox is Microsoft's getting into it. PlayStation's getting into it. NVIDIA kind of took the very slow route instead of trying to rush stuff, because there's been issues on the other platforms with different types of issues between latency, input lag, image quality, all that kind of stuff. So they kind of slow rolled it, and it just got released a week and a half ago into wherever can get it. And it's both a free and paid tier. It's a little bit about saying Activision Blizzard had all their games on it and then pulled their games off here last week, at least we hopefully temporarily. But it still supports tons of games. A lot of the new big hits coming out are supposed to be supported on it. And there's really two neat features of it. If you pay now, you actually get a discounted where you can get higher graphics options and stuff. But the free tier is pretty much the same as the paid, except you stand in a queue to get in. So if all the servers are busy, you're kind of in a wait list, unlike if you're paying. And what it does allow the user to do is play high-end PC games at full graphic options on very low-end devices. You don't need that $2,000 gaming PC anymore to, you know, do the very high frame rate stuff. You can do it on a Chromebook. You can play World of Warcraft, because people are doing this, on a tablet. You can play it on your TV easily enough. It kind of removes all the horsepower required for high-end gaming out of your house to centralized servers. Now, depending on your ISP, it's just like Netflix and other stuff. Depending on your ISP and stuff, you're going to have a different experience. But in many games, and even first-person shooters, a lot of people would say, well, that latency would kill. But it's been proven over and over now, especially if you're in any major or well-connected city in the United States, it actually works very well. For input lag and for latency, even the fastest paced games. And if you're not even playing the fastest place, you can play your games just about any place, on the bus, as long as you have some type of cellular activity. On different devices, it doesn't take that much bandwidth. It takes some, especially if you want to do like 4K gaming on your TV set and stuff. It does require some bandwidth, but you can kind of scale it all the way down depending on the game you're playing. So
that's very interesting how they're going to figure out how to get the computing back to the, you know, back to the cloud or wherever, and allow folks that have the not so powerful PCs to enjoy those high FPS games.
And on the page here, you can turn on what's called RTX options, which is the highest end video card that NVIDIA sells. So it's just like having the latest PC that just came out last month, that $5,000 liquid cooled PC.
Jeff, we got to go, Jeff. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the show. We'll see you again in 2 weeks.